Now we're getting excited. Purim is right around the corner, so opportunity to introspect into this wonderful time. Gonna take a very different look, a deep look at Amalek. We said Behind the Mask, I believe, is the title of the Shurim. And so we're going to take a look at Amalek, who they are, what the challenge was, and of course how Klal Yisrael overcame the challenge. And that is important because all these challenges persist to this day, and therefore we have to know how to deal with it. So first of all, when Chaim, when you imagine what Haman looked like, what do you envision?
I'm imagining, you know, those guys from like Qatar wearing those coats, the big gowns,
right?
Big belly.
What?
Small.
Why big belly? Because he probably likes to eat.
Likes
a
to
lot.
Eat doesn't do much work.
Probably doesn't hit the gym.
Yeah, he leans while he eats back. That's what I imagine. He's wearing a coat, big belly, small arms and legs.
And the teeth, does he have like a nice smile or is it?
He's got a nice beard.
Oh, he does have a nice beard.
Nice beard, but he's got quite nice teeth. Yeah, no, actually, I imagine he cares much about his how he looks to the people.
Oh, so then why would he have a belly and short arms?
Because he doesn't work hard. That's what I imagine.
Belly is a sign of wealth.
Belly is a sign of wealth.
It was.
Good. Okay. Good. Okay, thank you. Now, next question. If we were to ask most of the people at that time, you know, about the Amalekim, and we were to offer them multiple choice question, are they, you know, moral, upstanding, good people, or are they evil, vicious, violent, corrupt individuals? What do you think people would say?
I think that the Jews would say that they're corrupt, violent, immoral people. I think all the other people would say that they're probably moral, that they're officials in the government, and they're probably the non-Jews would probably say they were good people.
Oh, okay, very good. So check this out. This is most of this is going to be based on the Ksavim of Rav Tzadok HaKohen. So first and foremost, he says, take a look that when Amalek attacked us, who did they attack? They attacked, the Pasuk says, I'll read to you the Pasuk, when they attacked us in the desert, Asher karacha b'derech, the Amalek, they happened upon you on the way, vayizanev b'cha, and they tailed you, means they attacked us from the tail, from the back, kol haneche shalim acharecha, all those that were straggling behind you, trailing at the end, vata ayev v'yageh, and you were tired and exhausted, Velo Yare Elokim, and did not fear God. Rashi on that comments and says, Koha Nechashalim Acharech, all those who were straggling after you. Why are there people straggling? Who are these stragglers? Says Rashi. Nope. Chaseri Koach, the people that were lacking strength, Machmas Chata'am, because of their sins, Shayahan Anan Poltan, that the cloud of glory would spit them out, would push them out. So the good, upstanding, righteous Yidden were inside the clouds of glory, protected. The obvious question is, right, how did Amalek manage to attack us? We know we were surrounded by clouds of glory. Those clouds protected us from all the catapults and the arrows and everything that the Egyptian army was shooting. So how did Amalek manage to attack us? Answers Rashi, that those that were exhausted from sinning were pushed out of the clouds. They were trailing behind, and that's the ones that Amalek attacked. Okay? Now, the truth is, in the end of that pasuk, there's two very difficult words. Because the pasuk says, again, that Amalek who happened upon you on the way, and they tailed you, meaning they attacked your tail, those that were straggling behind you, and you were tired and exhausted, Velo Yare Elohim. And he did not fear God. Rashi says that is referring to Amalek. Amalek did not fear God. Okay. So we're seeing that Amalek attacks Dafka, the Rishoyim of Klal Yisrael. Additionally, the Midrash says that Amalek came bo bekocho shel zekeno. He came with the power of his elder. Who is the elder of Amalek? Aaron? I'm saying the yichus of Amalek.
Esav.
The concubines. So Amalek came with the power of Esav. What's the power of Esav? Midrash says that he's like a pig. He sticks out his split hooves and says, "See, look at me." Right? When pigs lie down, unlike other animals, they lie down. With their feet tucked in underneath them. But pigs, when they lie down, they stick out their feet in front of them. Why do they do that? Alex?
To
show everyone they have their split hooves. That's their sign of kashrus. Right? So that's the power of Esav, is displaying his external righteousness. Right? So Amalek came. They themselves came with the power of, look how righteous we are, displaying their power of their elder of Esav. And they attacked Dafka the Rishoyim, Dafka the sinners from Klal Yisrael. Furthermore, when they, Rashi there on the spot again says that when they killed those Jews, they says that Amalek mutilated the Jewish bodies. They cut off their place of bris milah, and they threw it to the heavens. They said, "Is this what you chose? Is this what you wanted?" Right now, yeah. Rashi brings vayizanev becha. I translated earlier. They tailed you. They attacked you from the tail. Says Rashi. Like a zanav, a hit on the tail. Choteich milos, they cut off the circumcision. Vezarkam klapimal, and they threw them to Hashem, to heaven. I think Rav Baruch is identifying very correctly that it's terrifying how similar it sounds to the events of October 7th, which just happened to us, right? Which, if you haven't heard these stories, it's worthwhile to hear the miraculous stories that happened on that day. there's a famous big yeshiva, literally right over there. So there was a big yeshiva, literally right over there where Hamas attacked. In a yeshiva called Tifrach, massive, hundreds of bachur, and the terrorists were caught afterwards. And they asked, "Why you guys attacked this place all around, and you didn't? Why didn't you go in?" And they said, "No, we had plans. Literally, we had plans exactly how we're gonna go. We're gonna close off the front entrance, the back entrance. We're gonna go. We're gonna kill all of them." And when they were about to approach, they saw the whole place was literally on fire. He said, the whole place is on fire. We had nowhere to go into. So there's all sorts of stories like this, which is literally reminiscent of the clouds of glory, protecting them. There's other places where they were going to go in to a religious moshav, one of the religious ones, and they said that two great imams were waving them away. And afterwards they identified them on the picture that was the Bani Shai and somebody else. Anyways, incredible stories. But at the same time, who is it that got attacked? Very sadly. The very first place that was attacked, the overwhelming majority of the casualties was that disgusting, terrible concert thing, which I hear, I didn't look into it on purpose. Apparently they had some sort of a Buddha in the middle of it, and they were doing drugs, and it was like these were the people that were they were straggling behind, they were outside the clouds of glory, very sadly, right? And here they come, and they're saying, as they're mutilating these bodies, they're saying, "Is this what the God? This is God. This is what you want. These are the people that you chose. These are the chosen people. No, we're the chosen people." That's what Amalek was saying. In fact, we know that it's not very simple. Who is the chosen one? Who is the righteous? Right? Who is the race? So it's on the one hand that the Pasuk says that Amalek is described as righteous Goyim Amalek. Amalek is the righteous, the beginning, the top of the nations. On the other hand, the Jewish people are called Reishis Tvuasa. We are the first of Hashem's crop. Now, of course, if you look at these verses carefully, it's very obvious which one, especially from the continuation of the verses, it's very obvious what the truth is. But the fact that each one is called a Reishis makes it that there is a Sichsuch, there is just like there was a competition between Esav and Yaakov. Who is the firstborn? Who is the righteous? Who is the one deserving of the blessings? So Amalek attacked us. It wasn't just an attack of some vicious barbarians. The attack of Amalek was an attack of indignation, a claim of deserving themselves to be the ones to be chosen. In fact, it's fascinating. After this, there's a battle. And Moshe selects Yeshua to go and attack. And he himself is standing on top of the mountain and the whole thing. And the result of that is what? It doesn't say that. It does not say we won. It doesn't say Vayinatzchum, that we defeated them. It says Yeshua weakened them. It just says he weakened them by the edge of the sword. Vayachalosh Yehoshua es Amalek vesamo lifi charef. So first, weakening is such a... When Moshe Rabbeinu fights against Sichon and against Og, he kills every single one of them, right? We don't lose any casualties. Here you have Yeshua selecting the most righteous people. They're going out to war against them. and like there's a war, we're winning, we're losing, depends on if Moshe's, our hands are up or down, they're fighting the whole day, and Moshe is literally having to be supported. It's a pretty big thing. I mean, Moshe just wiped out the entire Egyptian army just recently, right? And here's Moshe getting so tired, holding up his hands, and it's a back and forth, it's a back and forth. And then finally, Yeshua manages to weaken them. How does he do it? So the, in English, we translate it with the edge of the sword. But the Hebrew over there is lifi charev. And fi charev means the mouth of the sword. Now, simplest thing, the mouth of the sword is because the sword, so to speak, cuts in, it bites into flesh, whatever it is. So it's the mouth of the sword, is the cutting edge of the sword. But the Rav Tzadok sees in this a hint that it was only with the power of the mouth do we manage to get any advantage over them, to defeat them. Why? Because the mouth is where I can reveal to you what I believe, what I, you know, my internality, my what's in my heart. But on the realm of actions, in the realm of actions, we had nothing on them. We had nothing over them. Which is unbelievable. Furthermore, Amalek, now we come to the Purim story. Haman comes to the king. Now we know that whenever, the Midrash says, whenever throughout Megillas Esther he's referred to as the king, without the specification of Achashverosh, it means it's an allusion to the Melech Malchei Malchim HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It means the king, Hashem. So Haman comes to the king and he offers 10,000 talents of silver. Now silver in Hebrew is kesef. Kesef from a language of Lavan says to Yaakov, I know that you've yearned for your father's house. Nichsof nichsafta. Kesef is from a language of to yearn or to desire. So, says Rav Tzadok, that Haman was showing the king how much he desires. You know how much I desire to take this place, that we should be the chosen ones from you? I'm prepared to turn over all my desire, 10,000 talents of silver. That's all the desire over there, right? To serve the king, to give to the king. When Haman cast the lot, and the lot fell out in Adar, Haman rejoiced a great joy. A great joy, the Gemara says. Why? Because the lot fell on the day that Moshe Rabbeinu passed away. And so that, so he viewed that as being a sign from heaven that he's going to be successful. Sounds like a pretty religious man. Furthermore, it fell out on the end of the year. Adar is the last month of the year, so this is the end of the year. So too, it's going to be the end, Chas v'Shalom, of the Jewish people. Right? By the way, when Haman describes the Jewish people, what does he say to the king? He says, Yeshno Am Echad. There is one people amongst your lands. He says the language of Yeshno, the Gemara Megillah Darshan's Yeshno Yashan Min HaMitzvahs. The people that they're sleeping from the mitzvahs. Because Haman's claim to the Melech is, it's not worth it for you to keep them. Take my desire to serve you, take my kesef, take us instead. These people, they're not doing mitzvahs. They're not deserving of it. Okay, so the obvious question that we're going to need to address is, so how do we address all this, right? How do we manage to answer all these claims that are being laid against us? How do we manage to be saved from this? We're pointing out that Haman seems to have a good point, right? He's saying the Jewish people are sleeping from mitzvahs, similar to when the predecessors of Haman, which is a Malik, attacked us on the way. So over there, we were described as being hanechashalim, the stragglers, the one that were straying behind. They were sinning. They were not keeping the mitzvahs. They were cast out from the clouds of glory. And guess what? The Jewish people weren't in Persia currently on a nice vacation, right? You know what we're doing in Persia? After sinning and sinning and sinning for a really long time, eventually Hashem had enough and he destroyed the Beis HaMikdash and threw the Jewish people out of the land of Israel into slavery of Babylonia, and then, you know, that molded into the slavery of Persia. So this is the Jewish people are currently tremendously distant from Torah mitzvahs. They have already, they're attending the royal feast celebrating Ahasuerus' kingship, which really means his kingship over the world, even though he's wearing the garments of the Kohen Gadol and at the feast, right? So this is not a good point in the Jewish people's spiritual standing. In fact, Rav Tzadok applies to this the pasuk in Shir Shirim, "Ani yeshena v'li bi'er." I am asleep, but my heart is awake. So it means the Jewish people were, like we said, the Haman himself described us as being Yeshno, Yesh Am, the of a nation that is sleeping from the mitzvahs. That they're sleeping. So then they don't deserve to be the chosen ones. So the question that we need to understand is, so what was the answer? How was this claim rebuffed? In what way did Mordechai, Esther, and Klal Yisrael of that time manage to counteract such an accusation, such a claim against us? Okay, so we mentioned already that Purim is in the end of the year. Not only is Purim in the end of the year, but the Gemara also says that the miracle of why it asks, why is Esther compared to the Ayal Sashachar, Pasuk in Tehillim, right? So it says that just like the Ayal Sashachar, the raising of the beams, the first beams of the morning is the end of the night. That's the break of dawn. I think in English you say, right? Break of dawn. So too, which is the end of the night. So too, Purim is Sof Kol Hanisim. Nighttime is a time of miraculous, of supernatural, etc. And Purim is the very last moment, you know, just as the first rays of dawn are breaking, that's the last moments of the night. So So Purim is the Sof Kol Anisim. It's the end. It's the end of the miracles. It's the end of the miraculous. So we're talking about somehow there's a power in this end to what? To really be something really wonderful, right? We know the Gemara, the same Gemara that says that Haman rejoiced. He cast the lots, and it fell on the day that Moshe Rabbeinu passed away. But the Gemara says, but he didn't know that it's also the day that Moshe Rabbeinu was born. So there's some sort of a counteracting power, actually a positive power, to the end. So what is this power of the end? So just like in when we're, any creative process has lots of exciting things happening in the beginning, right? It's usually seeing tremendous breakthroughs and accomplishment and everything. But ultimately it leads to the end of that process. And in the end, there's not really anything that happens except for the fulfillment of everything. And Rav Tzadok compares this to the 7 days of creation. Right? The 7 days of creation, every day has something really important happening, whereas the last day, nothing really happens. What happens on the seventh day? Nothing. Rest. Right? Bo Shabbos, Bo Menucha. On Shabbos, rest came. Nothing. It was the end of the creative process. So he says that that is the... If we look at the Torah commanded holidays, so we have the three regalim, the three chagim, which are, who knows what they are? Okay. Pesach, rearrange it. Pesach, Shavuos, and Sukkos. Yeah? And those three correspond to Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. Right? So that's three. And then we have two more very big ones. People should be able to get those. Two big holidays. High holidays. Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur. Very good. So that's two more. Now there's one that many people might not get. It's kind of viewed as an extension of Sukkot. Shmini Atzeres. Very good. Right? So we got Pesach corresponding to Avraham Avinu, the side of kindness. We got Shavuos corresponding to the side of Yitzchak Avinu, of strict justice. We have Sukkos corresponding to Yaakov, the balance between them. And then there's a drop down from there, an extra little day that's appended to the bottom of Sukkos, which corresponds, which is Shmini Atzeres, which the Gemara says a Chag B'fnei Atzmo. Really, it's a holiday in its own right. Right? So that's going to correspond. So those six are all holidays that the Jewish people are active on. All those require the Kiddush HaChodesh, sanctification of the new moon, etc. We're active with those. We're doing something. And then there's the seventh one where we're passive. Where we don't do. We don't go up to Yerushalayim. We're not active. We're not establishing it. It's just Kviya V'Kaima. It's established and standing already. Rav Baruch, what's that? Kviya V'Kaima. The Kiddush of Shabbos. Right? Like the Gemara in Arei Pesachim says. Shabbos Kviya V'Kaima. So the power of Shabbos is unique, it's different than the other ones. So, and that is the end of this process. Shabbos is the end of the creative process on the seventh day of creation. And it's the also where we come to a creative stop, and it's called Midah of Malchus, of kingship. It's the attribute of Emuna, faith. That is going to be brought out in the strongest, clearest way in the world, of course, Lashed Lavo. In the future, is going to be Yom Shekulo Shabbos, a day that's entirely Shabbos, right? But in the meantime, Shabbos is Me'ein Olam Haba. It's like Olam Haba. Shabbos is a taste of Olam Haba, a day where we're in rest, right? Now that's good for us, but where is it that the world gets to experience this? Where is it that the world gets to relate to such a thing, where Hashem is revealed? Olam Haba is a place, is a time where Hashem is revealed in the world. Now we as Jews get to connect to that, to experience that on Shabbos. By what? By abstaining. Usually we're very active. On Shabbos we abstain from our activity and leave the room, leave the opportunity for ourselves to connect to the fact that we don't need to be doing anything. Kodesh Baruch Hu has everything under control. 6 days you do all your work. The 7 days rest. Right? And Hashem will take care of everything. That is the power of Shabbos. Question is, where is it that the rest of the world, where is it that the Goyim can connect to such a thing? Can connect to such a reality where Hashem is taking care of everything. He's in charge. He doesn't need you to do anything. So you might say, well, I know. He could also keep Shabbos. Right? Good idea. Right? So the Gemara in Sanhedrin, in case you need help remembering the daf of that Gemara, that is daf Nun Ches, letters Noach. And so daf Noach in Sanhedrin says, Reish Lakish says, Goy Shishavas Chayev Misa. A Goy, the rest of Shabbos is Chayev Misa. Why is it that such a harsh decree, a goy that keeps Shabbos, chayv misa? So first of all, Reish Lakish learns it from Pasuk in Parshas Noach, which says, Yom v'lay lo shish bosu. Day and night they will not stop. Sure, I'll try. So a goy that keeps Shabbos has obligated himself in death. Okay? Now, Rav Tzadok explains that it's not because, per se, that he's such a bad man, that he's necessarily so ill-intended. Maybe he's even a nice person. But the point is that resting on Shabbos is a person saying, I live in a world where Hashem is fully revealed, where Hashem runs the world, and there's no need for man's exertion. There's no need to do anything. On Shabbos, you're not allowed Shavas, right? Shavas means Shabbos. It's the language of Shavas, to rest. So it's a day of rest. Rest means that, so who's taking care of everything? If we're resting, so who's taking care of everything? What? HaKadosh Baruch Hu is taking care of everything. So, that's quite a level to live on. if a person cannot live on such a level, it's like walking into an oven. If you're not designed to be able to exist on such a level, if you walk into an oven, you obligate yourself in death. Not because you're a bad person per se, because you're doing something that you it is not congruent, that cannot be with your existence. Being in the oven and existing, it doesn't work. They'll be to be in a reality where Hashem is revealed.
And they're relying on their sustenance, pouring on a Kodesh Baruch Hu on that day, and that's like walking into an oven?
Yeah. I want to propose maybe a little bit of an explanation for this, a bit more. The Gemara says clearly, Gemara Sanhedrin says, that the entirety of Olam Haba, the entirety of the next world, was created only for the Jewish people. We learned the Derech Hashem here. Everyone here hopefully has learned the Derech Hashem. If you haven't, there's a Amud Yomi of Derech Hashem that you should join. But the way that we have learned it, so we know that it means Olam Haba was created for Adam for man, the one that's meant to be the recipient of the goodness. Now the problem is that man sinned, and he fell from that level. And the only one that came back to that level was Avram Avinu, and from him came the Jewish people, etc. So, the point is, true Adam Atem, Navi says Adam Atem, and the Gemara in Yevamos Darshan is Atem Karuim Adam Velo Umos Olam. You're the Adam and not the nations of the world. They're not the full Adam, that's why they don't have 613 mitzvahs like we do. So if the entirety of the next world exists only for Adam, only for the Jewish people, So what's going to be with the righteous Gentiles? We know, the Gemara says, that the Chassidi Umos HaOlam, the righteous Gentiles of the world, those that keep the seven mitzvahs Bnei Noach, will have a chelik in Olam Haba. They will have a portion in Olam Haba. Portion as opposed to a full Olam Haba. A full Olam Haba every year, who's a good person, who keeps Torah mitzvahs, has Olam Haba. Rishoyim of the Jewish people have a chelik in Olam Haba. Tzadikim have 310 worlds in Olam Haba. Yesh. You might say Yesh. They have full Olam Haba. Rishoyim have a chelik. Why do the Rishoyim only have a chelik? Because they don't have their own Olam Haba. All they can do is they can share, they can live vicariously. Rishoyim, for the Jewish people, can live vicariously, so to speak, through their brethren, because they were all one nation, and they are a member of that nation. So then, to that extent, they have a chelik in Olam Haba. And so too the Hasidi Umos Olam, the pious members of the nations of the world, also have a chelik in Olam Haba. Why? Because they facilitate our being close to Hashem. So again, the point being, they build the world, they make bridges, they do like the Gemara in the beginning of Avodah Zarah says, that when the nations of the world will come as nations to ask from Hashem to themselves as a nation, have the next world, Hashem is going to say, well, these things that you were doing, you weren't doing them to help the Jewish people. Their claim is going to be, we're doing things to facilitate the Jewish people in serving you. So you see that there is a hava mina, there is a side of a possibility to say that they should have a portion of the next world for that, which is correct for individual people, Hasidu Masol, individual ones. They keep the seven mitzvahs of Bnei Noach, they can actually do that. But as a nation, that's not what they do. Anyway, coming back to our point over here. So the point is that these people, their whole ability to relate to Hashem is only through the Jewish people. They cannot be in the presence of where Hashem is running everything and there's no need to do anything because their whole existence is to do things in this world, to improve this world, in order to facilitate the Mamlechas Kohenim V'Goy Kadosh, the kingdom of priests and the holy nation, which is the Jewish people, to serve Hashem with their support. So that's their reality. But to be in the presence of Hashem in a way that is unimpeded, unfiltered, that just Hashem runs the world, you don't need to be doing anything, that is Me'ein Olam Haba, the full Gilui Shechina, that they can't tolerate. So much so, Rav Salik says an unbelievable thing. He says, how did Makas Bechoros happen? The killing of the firstborn in Egypt, how did that happen? With the Gilui Shechina. We know that simultaneously with the killing of the firstborn, there was the revelation of the Divine Presence in Egypt. And that was the revelation of Divine Presence that we clung to, that we became elevated and clinging to Hashem through it, to the point that therefore we didn't die. So people think, oh, we didn't die, like there was like this thing coming and we kind of jumped up and grabbed out to Hashem, so we didn't die. No, the thing that killed the Egyptians, says Rav Tzadik, was the Gilui Shechina. Why? Because they couldn't tolerate such a level of divine revelation. They're not able to withstand such levels of heat. So what for us is basking in the divine presence, for them is getting burnt up into a crisp. No question. Because it had to do with the Gilui to the Bechor. Now Jewish people are all a Bechor. So we were relevant to that. Obviously, it's not Olam Haba, right? Olam Haba is Olam Haba. Okay, so the answer cannot be that the nations of the world get to experience this through Shabbos. That cannot be. So, but there is somewhere where they can experience it, and we will get to talk about that. Probably next week. I'm guessing you can figure out which day of the year there is a way that they can experience it. If you can't, talk to your Echmiel and explain it to you.
What's the premise? In order for them to get a chilek, they have to experience it.
First, it's not a kasha, it's a shaila. I mean, it doesn't have to be a kasha. So, step one is a kash. It doesn't have to be a kash. It can just be a shaila. Is there such a day? The answer is there is, yes.
Just so I can follow your logic, the end of the witness is saying how Purim is the end of the year. I'm talking about how miracles are, it's our last opportunity to kind of capture miracles. And then we jump into this tangent about how.
So now we're going to try to weave it back. Okay. Right? Then we put that on pause. Now we're discussing the end. We're discussing the power of the end. And the power of the end is Shabbos. It's the attribute of divine conduct called Malchus, kingship. And it is Olam Haba.
And now we're trying to answer how the non-Jewish nations will also participate in it.
And the answer is going to be Purim. But that's why Purim is the end. So Purim is the end, Shabbos is the end. But Shabbos is the end. Olam Haba is the real end. But Shabbos is Me'ein Olam Haba. That's the end for us. That's the day of rest for us. But there's also Purim for the rest of the world. We'll talk about how that is. That's gonna be the discussion. That's gonna be the understanding. And then all of that will come back then as help and explain how it is that led to the downfall of Amalek and to the elevation of the Jewish people.
Sinners over here that are striking behind.
It wasn't all of Israel in a bad way at that point, right? We were redeemed out of Egypt, not through our own merit. So who was it that was like, who was it that was struggling if all of Israel was?
So the question is, for those who didn't hear, how is it that there's stragglers? How is it there's people that are expelled from the clouds of glory? Wasn't it the fact that the Midrash says that when we're going through the splitting of the sea, I mean, a little bit, that the angels of Egypt said, well, why are you drowning the Egyptians, saving the Jewish people? They're not better. These are idol worshippers. And those are idol worshippers, not much better. The answer is, however, that since then, most of the Jewish people, you know, got their act together. They were trying to live, you know, in a divine way. They were in the presence of the clouds of glory. They were trying, and there were certain people who were failing miserably at that. So they were thrown out from the clouds of glory. Okay, so that was a discussion of the attribute of Malchus, of kingship. Now, the Midrash says the king has a daughter that he never likes to be separated from, and that daughter is called Tefillah, prayer. Right? Prayer, to a large extent, is the same concept. Those of you that have been here for the Nesiv HaAvoda Shiurim that we've been doing, right? They're talking about Tefillah, talking about prayer. So you know the culmination of the tefillah, when one actually stands in a silent Shemon Esrei, you stand in a upright position, feet together, arms folded in front of you, eyes downcast. That's a position of standing in the presence of the king. Right? So that is the same level of Malchus, except that he, obviously, we are not able to be, we're not the Malch himself. We are approaching in prayer. So that's what the Midrash compares. That it's like a daughter of the king. That the king never, he doesn't let the princess go out by herself too far. I mean, wherever there's prayer, is in the presence of the king. King must be. Praised and prayed to. Okay? So, David HaMelech says, Ani Tefillah, I am prayer. He says that about himself. Like he is, by the way, David is a king. So it's not, that's not a happenstance. Additionally, the word Ani itself, the word Ani is first person. So it's an interesting question that Rav Tzadok asks. Sometimes the prophets speak on behalf of Hashem in first person. Ani, you know, whatever it is, I'm going to throw this, I'm going to bring this, I'm going to build, I'm going to destroy. Well, how can a prophet say those words? Is he God? Is a prophet God that he can say the words Ani? He's saying as long as he does the bunny ears with his fingers, it's not that he's saying it, then it's okay. Right. I agree. That's probably how I thought about it until I heard the Kasha from Rav Tzadok. But I think Rav Tzadok is pointing out that it's a little bit presumptuous, no? To kind of speak in God's voice, okay, like you probably have to make your voice really low when you I am God, right? Like that. So he says the brings from the Midrash that the word Ani is actually a code word that Hashem uses for the divine revelation, for the divine presence. Divine presence is the lowest manifestation of Hashem, the Shekhinah, the divine presence, and that divine presence can be referred to with the word Ani. Now, where does the Shekhinah live? Where does the divine presence live? If I want to find it, where is it? Of a person. You're being very specific. Okay, all right. On the top of the head, which you're right. There is a statement. Chacham einav barosho. A wise person, his eyes are in his head. So the Midrash asks, Chacham einav barosho. His eyes are in his head. Where would you think his eyes are going to be? Right, his feet. So he says, rather it means that Chacham is always looking towards his head, towards the top of his head, looking at the divine presence that's there. But that's a little bit good, Chaim, but even too good. I want a more general, where do we look? We look, when Hashem commands us to build the Mishkan, what's the words he uses? Wow. Build for me a Mishkan, v'shochanti b'socham. And I will dwell in you. So the place where the divine presence dwells is inside of every yid. Yeah? So in that, to that regard, if a Navi can tap in to the divine presence which resides in his heart, then he can literally say, Ani, I am Hashem. Right? I'm going to do the following. I'm doing this, I'm doing that. And it's correct, because he's speaking for the divine presence that is dwelling in his heart. A very dangerous idea, of course. Please do not start speaking in first person on behalf of God. Please. Right? But the point is, of course, the real, the poshup shot is like Alex said, the prophet is speaking as a representative on behalf of God, but the Rav Tzaddik still feels that there should be some level where he should be able to relate to that. And he's relating to that because the manifestation of divine presence is in him.
Well, to relate to how Moshe brought that same issue as well at the burning bush. And I believe he, when he received his prophecy from there, he asked from Hashem, how will I convince everyone that you're communicating with me?
Yeah.
He said to me, gave him the name Hashem, right? Say, like, that's from me or something.
That's at the burning bush. Hashem revealed to Moshe the name Ekya Sher Ekya. I will be what I will be. Let's. Not sure if it's the same concept, so we'll talk afterwards. Okay, just trying to. Not trying. Okay, we actually have to stop here. So we'll pick up with Tefillah again next week. We'll discuss Tefillah, and then we'll come back to tying in Purim and the victory over Amalek. As a shem.